Okay, tonight over in Daniel chapter 11. What I'm going to teach you is pretty much, you open any commentary, amillennial, premillennial, dispensational, covenant, Judaism, they're all going to say almost the same exact thing. And so what you see in chapter 11, well, at least to verse 35, what you see in chapter 11 is just pure history that is fulfilled, that was prophecy when he was making this. Sometimes hundreds of years prior to it being fulfilled. And so you're gonna see this play out. Now, this is fun because this chapter is better than any soap opera you'll watch. It's amazing what they do. But this chapter, starting in verse 5, which is where we left off last week, starting in verse 5, this whole chapter then is about the conflict of the king of the north and the king of the south. And these are the two kings, two of the kings of that were Alexander the Great's generals that took over parts of his kingdom. Now, the king of the north, as I said last time, is Syria. And the king of the south is Egypt. And so you'll see this all the way through. Now, on your sheets, I tried to give you kind of a summary statement of the prophecy that was fulfilled in that verse that we just read. And I even tried to give you a date. Now, some of those dates I rounded off to the nearest five, especially if in a couple of different history books, the dates were a little off, I would kind of round it off. But what you'll see there is that the dates, I mean, it goes one right after the other on how this is fulfilled. All right? And so we're going to look at this now as we look at chapter 11. The battles between the king of the north, the Seleucids, and the king of the south, the Ptolemies, the Egyptians. All right? And so, let's just start it. Let's just go into verse 5 and let's look at it. It says, "Also, the king of the south shall become strong." Now, I'll write this up here for you. This first king and the king of the south is Ptolemy the First. Ptolemy the First. He is the first king of the south. He proclaims himself the king of Egypt. And what we see in verse 5 is that he shall become strong. And he was a very, very powerful general. He established his dominance very quickly, according to this historical narrative. And then what we see there is, as well as one of his princes, one of his, those that served with him in the army. And that prince right there, one of his princes that we have, this is Seleucus the First. Seleucus the First. And so what you have now, as the beginning, you have Ptolemy the First in the south, you have Seleucus the First in the north. Now, these are all going to be Ptolemies. The number after, the Roman numeral after it may change, but they're all Ptolemies. These are either going to be Seleucuses or Antiochuses. All right, they'll alternate their names sometimes, but they're all the king of the north. And it says, "And he shall gain power over him, and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion." All right, so we have Ptolemy the First. He's the main one of this verse. He became the king of Egypt up around 323 BC. He was ambitious. And he basically, he wanted to extend his rule up into Cyprus, which is this big island right here, and then up into Asia Minor. Well, when you go up into Asia Minor, then you're going up into the King of the North's territory. So you can see already what's happening. There's already starting to be some turmoil, even though these guys started out as comrades and buddies and all of that. And so he ruled The Ptolemies ruled in Egypt until 30 B.C., all the way for almost 300 solid years. The Ptolemies ruled in Egypt for that time. Now, Seleucus is the king of the north. He gained authority of Babylon, that kind of that green and blue shaded area up there, not all the way down. Down to here. Seleucus was this area right here, and even Arabia, but nobody went into that area because you didn't want to die because there was no water out there. It was just desert. Okay? And so he gained that and that Babylonian area. And then what happened is that in 316 B.C., one of the other generals, remember there were four of them all together, one of the other generals attacked Seleucus, and Ptolemy came to his rescue. And so what we see there is at the beginning there's kind of this comradeship, but it quickly dissipates as the years go on. All right? So, Ptolemy the first, Seleucus the first. Fulfilled history. Right there. Okay? Now go to verse 6. And at the end of some years they shall join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. Now here's where the soap opera begins. Now, this is fun. Okay? But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her. Are you beginning to, she's given up. All right? Something happened there. And those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Now, there's a lot of hymns and he's and all of that in there. Let me tell you how this played out. Okay? By this time, because there were some years later, right? By this time, Ptolemy the second is the king over Egypt. It's Ptolemy the second. And so what Ptolemy did, and by this time, this is Antiochus the second. Well, okay, let me just do this. There's a woman involved. What was kind of the thing when two kings wanted to join forces in this ancient Near Eastern time? What would they do? They would marry their daughter. And that's exactly what happened. Okay? Ptolemy the second married his daughter Bernice to Antiochus II. All right? And that occurred about 245 B.C. Now, what this forced Antiochus to do is that he had to divorce his wife, Laodice. All right? Now, by the way, the town Laodicea up in Asia Minor, that's one of the churches that's written to in Revelation, Laodicea, that's named after this lady right here. Okay? Because she was originally the queen in this area. All right? But when Bernice comes on the scene, then Antiochus II divorces Laodicea. Now, or Laodice. And now this forces them to become now this kind of, they have this agreement. Now, it's not a real agreement. Both of them are conniving. Both of them are using this and all of that. But for right now, Antiochus II is playing the game. And so he's married to Bernice. Now, when Ptolemy II died, what do you think Antiochus II does? He divorces Bernice. And he goes back to Laodicea. All right? Well, so to gain revenge, Laodicea had Bernice and Bernice's infant son poisoned, murdered. All right? And she also poisoned Antiochus II. So now, oh, you bet. Laodicea is ticked. So she kills Bernice and Bernice's child. And she kills the man that divorced her, which is Antiochus II. Okay? And so, Laodicea then has a son And his son is named Seleucus the second. I get all this mixed up. Yeah. Seleucus the second. Well, guess who becomes king? Seleucus the second. Okay? That's Antiochus' son. Yeah, and since Antiochus was poisoned by his ex-wife, and then Bernice and her son was poisoned by Antiochus' ex-wife, then Seleucus became the next king. All right? And then what you see in verse 7 is now Ptolemy the third becomes king. Ptolemy the third. This is the king we see in verse 7. All right? So it says, but a branch of her roots, that's Bernice's roots, that's, in other words, this is Bernice's family, but from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. In other words, Ptolemy the third is related to Bernice. It's like he is her nephew. And so he is going to take vengeance upon the king of the north for what he did to his wife, Bernice. And so what Ptolemy does is he raises up an army. He's determined to avenge Bernice's death. And he goes up and he attacks Seleucus the second. That's verse 7. Trying to avenge his aunt. Now, what we see in verse 8 is that, and he shall carry their gods captive to Egypt. And, okay, what are gods associated with? Just think about that, okay? Because a lot of this is, I mean, it's very cryptic here, but when historians and scholars began to overlay history over this, it was like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. This fits exactly. Okay? So, it says that Ptolemy took the Seleucids' gods captive back to Egypt. Alright, that's telling us something. Keep going. With their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. And so what happened then is that Ptolemy the third attacked the king of the north, and when he did that, he was able to plunder their temples and their treasuries, their temples being their gods and the good stuff, of whatever it says there, and he took all of that stuff back down to Egypt. So, we can't say booty with high school students, but I'll say it to you, this is booty. Okay? So he took this booty back down to Egypt. Now, what we see historically, Ptolemy the third, that's the one in power right now. Ptolemy the third brings Egypt to its highest pinnacle of being this great kingdom that it ever gets. After Ptolemy the third, it's all downhill from there. But Ptolemy the third is a good king, at least for them, as far as leadership goes. Now, what happened, though, after this is that he does sign a treaty with Seleucus II, and there is some peace between these two nations. But don't think that Seleucus has forgotten about those treasures that this guy stole. So we go to verse 9. Also, the king of the north. Who's that? Seleucus II. Okay? Also, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south. Who's that? Ptolemy the third. What did you just learn in verse 9, the beginning of that? What did you just learn? That peace treaty is not happening anymore. There's a battle. Everybody see that? And who initiated the battle? Seleucus. There you go. Okay, so you're catching it. Okay, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. What happened here is that Seleucus II attempted to counterattack Egypt in order to go back and get all that treasure. But basically what happened is that he was kicked out of that kingdom with his tail between his legs. He went back to his own land. And that means he went back to his own land empty-handed. He didn't have anything with him. Okay? And so, he wasn't successful. Now, go to verse 10. However, his sons shall stir up strife. So, we've got to figure out who's the his. Is it Ptolemy or is it Seleucus? It's Seleucus. That was the main person up in verse 9. Okay? So, Seleucus's sons, let's say that 10 times. Seleucus's sons shall stir up strife. In other words, they're going to keep this going. All right? They're going to keep this thing going. And assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. And then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. There's a second time that's mentioned there. Okay? Now, Seleucus II died at about 220. About 220 B.C. And that's on there, right? That's on your sheets, right? All right? He had two sons. One of them was Seleucus III. He doesn't rule long. I'm not even going to take time writing his name out. It's too long. Okay? But what happens then is that Antiochus III. Antiochus III now becomes king of the north. By the way, if you Google this guy, this is Antiochus III the Great. Okay? And he was, with these standards, he was a good leader for the king of the north. Now, none of them were worth shooting. None of them. Okay? But he was a good leader as far as kings went in that time. And he leads the king of the north into some great victories. And so he wants to restore Syria's glory. And so Antiochus III, which is he stirs up strife, he attacked Egypt when he became king. He went against the king of the south. And what happened then is that it says he shall come and overwhelm and pass through. All right? When he attacks, he doesn't completely win over Egypt. He's not that successful, but what happens though is that he is able to push Egypt back, and he gains control of this land of Palestine. Okay? By the way, everybody, I mentioned this last time, everybody noticing the little nation that's between this little tug of war. Okay? There's a reason for that. All right? And so, Antiochus III, the Great, in that verse, pushes Ptolemy back, and he gains more control of this land. All right? Now, and he was very successful at driving them further. Now, let's go to verse 11. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage, and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemies. All right? Now, by this time, Ptolemy the Fourth is king. Ptolemy the Fourth is king. Ptolemy the Third was the one pushed back. Ptolemy the Fourth comes into power, and he wants this land back. All right, and so what we see in verse 11 is that he attacks the king of the north. Everybody's seeing a theme all the way through this. I hope you're seeing the theme. There is a theme in this. And so he attacks the king of the north. Now, what happens then is that Antiochus III raises an army. And the number is pretty much out there. It's about 70,000 men. That's a pretty good-sized army. He raises an army of 70,000 men, and he meets Ptolemy at the southern border of Israel. And that's where this battle takes place. Now, Antiochus lost most of his army, and Antiochus III the Great flees into the desert. He runs away from the battle. So Ptolemy the Fourth is victorious over this. Okay? Now, Look at verse 12. What should have happened is Antiochus the Fourth should have gone up into the northern territory and wiped this whole thing out, and it would have been over. But notice what he does in verse 12, because this is historically very accurate. When he was taken away, when he has taken away the multitude, in other words, when he destroyed that big army, his heart was lifted up. What does that mean? Prideful. His arrogance takes over. And his arrogance tells him, we don't need to go any further. This is the death blow to them. Their king has run up into the desert. And so what do? They go back to Egypt. Because he is so arrogant. So it says, and his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. In other words, he still, even though he destroys all those armies, because of his arrogance, he still isn't able to take that northern kingdom again. Okay? Now, verse 13 says, for the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former. What does that mean? He's going to go back with an army larger than the 70,000 that he had before. Okay? And notice, and he shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now, if you notice, it's about 205 B.C. there. Anybody see that? This is about 14 years after he was defeated in the previous verse. Okay? Now, I'm tired of writing names down. By this time, this is Ptolemy the Fifth. Ptolemy the Fifth is the Egyptian king. Depending on which historical site you read, Ptolemy the Fifth is about 2 years of age. Well, that's a problem. That's a problem if you're a king and you have a northern enemy that wants your place, right? So what is Antiochus going to do? He's going to take advantage of that. Because Antiochus the Fourth has just died. He has this infant son who is now the reigning king of Egypt. And so he raises up this very large army. It's about 14 years after what we saw in verse 12. Okay? See how Ptolemy the Fourth should have gone in there and done what he was supposed to. But his arrogance let him get out of there. So at this time, he goes in, and Antiochus the Third, he retakes Palestine. Okay, so he has Palestine once more. Once again, here's Israel right in the middle of all this. Are you seeing a pattern? North, south, north, south. I promise there's a point to that. Okay, north, south. Now, verse 14. Now, in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also, violent men of your people shall exalt himself in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. Okay? What happens then is that the Macedonians and the Jews, the violent men of your people, do you see that? They unite and they attack, hoping that they will have some kind of maybe liberty out of all this. But now look at what verse 15 says. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city. And the fortress of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Okay. First of all, what's this fortified city? Anybody have any notes in your Bible about what this fortified city is? Sidon. Okay? Now, what's Sidon? What's Sidon? Somebody said it. It's a port city. All right? Now, y'all want to take a rabbit trail real fast if you like the history stuff? Okay. But what happened is that when Alexander the Great is making his conquest, okay, one of the cities that he conquers is Sidon. Okay? Which was conquered previous to that. And so what the people did of Sidon is that there was a little island out in the bay. And they rebuilt their city of Sidon on that island. So if it's out in the water, they're pretty protected. Okay? And so when Alexander the Great comes through and he sees Sidon out there, he tells the people of Sidon, I want you to surrender and I won't hurt anybody. I just want your city. And they were like, forget you. Okay? Well, so what Alexander the Great, you don't ever tell Alexander the Great that. Okay? Because what he did is he just went down to Tyre and he conquered them. And then he enslaved all of those men in Tyre. And he took them up to Sidon. And he said to the men of Tyre, go take all of the rocks from the old Sidon and put it out in the ocean so we can walk out to there. And they were like, forget you. And so he starts killing them. And they're, okay, we'll do it. All right? So they're taking rocks out and they're dumping it in the ocean. It took them 6 months to build a road, literally in the ocean, from the coast out to Sidon. And then so what does Alexander the Great do? Walks out there and he takes over Sidon. There's actually a place in the book of Zechariah, and I was trying to find it, where it actually tells that. He walks out to Sidon or something like that when Sidon's out in the middle of the ocean. Okay? Well, by this time, this is a couple hundred years later, Sidon has been rebuilt again. It's still a Greek city, all right? But it's also a port city. It's a very important port city. And so they want that. The king of the north wants that. And so he builds a siege mound. Now, we're still Antiochus III. So in about 200 B.C., Antiochus III takes Sidon. He takes it. But what happens then is that was an uphill battle for him because the king of the south, which is Ptolemy the Fifth, who is 2 years old, maybe three, you know, or maybe one, probably his representative, instead of him leading, he hires this guy named General Scopas. Scopas is kind of a mercenary general for hire. And Scopas comes in and he leads the Egyptian army. And he was a force to be reckoned with. But even then, Antiochus III defeats him. And he takes Sidon. Now, just keep going to verse 16 because this is going to get old real fast. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will. And no one shall stand against him. What does that mean? He's going to be victorious there, okay? And he shall stand, he shall stand in the what? Glorious land. Where do you think that is? He's going to stand, okay, now that's the problem. He will stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. And what that means is at that time, Antiochus III takes Palestine one more time. Everybody's seeing how it's going back and forth. Back and forth in power. And so he takes that. And then what happened, history tells us that when Antiochus entered into Jerusalem, the Jews gave him a parade. And they welcomed him in. Because he was kind of seen as their deliverer. And then, as he's going through Palestine, he sets his eyes on Egypt. So Antiochus III heads back down to Egypt. All right? Now, look at verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter the strength of his whole kingdom. To enter with the strength of his whole kingdom. And upright ones with him, thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women. Oh, there's another woman that's involved here. Okay, who is that? I'll tell you in a second. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but he shall not stand with him or be with him. Now, what happens is that Antiochus III heads down to take over Egypt because Ptolemy the Fifth is how old? Two. So he's going, or maybe he's four or five by now. Still, I mean, it's much better to fight a king that's five than a king that's 30, right? And so he's going after Egypt now. All right? But there's something that's happening at this period of time. Notice the date. 195 B.C. Okay? It's around this time where the Roman Republic, not the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic is growing in strength. And the Roman Republic does not want to see the king of the north take over the king of the south, because then he's much too powerful. And so what happens then is the Romans come in and they force these two men to have a peace treaty. Well, if you're going to have a peace treaty between two kings in the ancient Near East, what did you do? You married it off. So what happened then is that Antiochus agreed to the peace treaty and he gave his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V. Now, this isn't the famous Cleopatra. Cleopatra is named after this. Cleopatra and Mark Antony doesn't appear until about 125 years later. Okay? But this is a Cleopatra. And Cleopatra marries Ptolemy V, who is still way too young to be married. Okay? But they're married. Now, what Antiochus wanted to do with Cleopatra is he wanted to put her in this kingdom to be a spy and to work that side of the table also. But what happened is that Cleopatra sided with her husband. And so now we have a peace treaty that's not exactly the way that everybody wants it. But the Roman Republic is on the other side going, you will play nice. You will play nice. All right? So in verse 18 it says, after this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many. In other words, that's Antiochus. Egypt is off the table, so what does he do? He turns and he heads up north. And he goes to the Aegean coast, the Aegean Sea. And he tries to take that. But by this time, guess who interferes again? Rome. Rome comes in and interferes one more time and he turns him back. Verse 19, then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land. In other words, what's he doing? He's going back home. He's going back home. But he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So what do you think that means? He died. So much for Antiochus III, the Great. He died. Okay? After that, we have Seleucus IV. Seleucus IV. Seleucus IV wasn't very well liked. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes. Well, that's never a popular person. Right? Now, the question is, why is he imposing so many taxes? Because remember, when his father went up north to the Aegean Sea to conquer and the Romans came and turned him back, you remember that? The Romans said, you know what, we're tired of you. We're sick of this. You're going to pay us tribute and you're going to continue to pay us tribute or we're going to attack you. And we're just going to decimate your little country. So, now his son is charged with raising taxes in order to pay these tributes to Rome. And so he is not very well liked. And what happens to him is that a Jewish tax collector poisons him. And he's done. So much for Seleucus IV. Because he's poisoned by one of his own taxes. But that's in 2 Maccabees 3:7. If you have a Catholic Bible at home, you can turn to 2 Maccabees 3:7 and read that. That's historically what happened. Okay? Now, we've come all that way to now the one that we want to focus on. Because Seleucus IV has I don't think it's his son. I think this is his nephew. I can't remember. But Seleucus IV dies, he's killed off, And now who we have next is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now, what does Epiphanes mean? Do what? It depends on where you go. Epiphanes, the illustrious one, the great one. It was just this awesome thing, all right? And that's what he called himself. He called himself Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now, what the Jews called him was Antiochus the Fourth Epimenes, which means crazy one, psycho one, and he was. Okay? He was crazy. He comes into power in 175 B.C. He is a madman. And he actually takes the throne. Yeah, he's the nephew of this guy. He takes the throne from this guy. He's still alive. He kills him off. And then Antiochus the Fourth becomes the next king. Now remember, Antiochus the Fourth, the Epiphanes, is the one that is the type of the Antichrist to come. So when we read what this guy does, you can see why he is definitely a type of the Antichrist. Because he is just evil. And he figures out ways to be more evil every time. In verse 22. Look at verse 21. Notice how he gets the kingdom. It starts off. He seizes the kingdom by deceit, intrigue. You see that? And everything that this guy does is deceitful, dishonest. He is despicable. Verse 22. With the force of a flood. Now, this is a water. A body of water that's forcing real fast. Now, literally, that's what a flood is. But what do you think figuratively a flood represents? An invading army. Yeah. It's people. Because remember, what are waters? What are seas? People. Nations. Gentiles, really. Okay? And so this is a flood. This is an army. And so with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away before him and be broken. And also the prince of the covenant. And so what happens is that he turns away an invading army. Egypt is coming up. Egypt is coming up. So he comes down, he turns them away. And while he is in Israel, everybody see that one, the Prince of the Covenant? Everybody see that? Well, at least according to Daniel, what's the covenant? What's the covenant that Daniel would know? The Mosaic Covenant. Okay? Now, what would be a prince of the Mosaic Covenant? The priest. That's exactly what it is. And so what happened here is that once he turned around these Egyptians and he sent them back, what he did was he deposed the high priest in Israel and he put his own high priest in there. Okay? Historically, that's exactly what happened. Now, go to verse 23. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. There's the word again. And he shall come up and be strong with a small number of people. And he shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches. And he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. What he did in order to increase his popularity is that he went into all the different treasuries around the southern kingdom. He went into all the different treasuries. He got all the money out. And he bribed his officials so that they would all follow him. He would also have parades where people were lined up along the street and he would throw money at them. Well, then you become a pretty popular king when you do stuff like that. Okay? But it was all for a reason. It was to get him to be popular. It was deceitful. And that's what that says. And historically, that's exactly what happened. Verse 25. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, which by this time is Ptolemy the Sixth. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. What happened is that they raised their army and they decided that they couldn't fight one another. So what happens is that they developed a false peace. And they're all they're doing is trying to deceive one another. Ptolemy the VI and Antiochus the IV, they're deceiving one another. All right? Now, where did I leave off? I'm sorry. They devise plans against each other. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacy shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. What happens is because of this deception, he's kind of making the back door around, and he's killing off lots of people. But what they're doing, they're eating. They're Ptolemy and Antiochus, what are they doing? They're eating together. Because what if you're eating with somebody in that culture, what does that mean? Peace, you're in covenant, you have fellowship with them. And that's what's being... Antiochus doesn't care. But this is what he's doing. So he's eating with his king, and he's keeping him in this deceitful position. Now look at verse 27. But both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil. Now, which one's the best? All right. That's a good answer, the little laugh. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. You see that? They're having these meals, and they're talking about peace, and they're patting each other on the back. And what they would love to do is stab each other in the heart. All right? But it shall not prosper, for the end will stand, will still be at the appointed time. What happened is that all through this, Antiochus Epiphanes could still not capture Egypt. Through all this deceit and deception and lying, but he met his match. Because Ptolemy was just as deceitful and lying and miserable as he was. By the way, you guys are getting the tip of the top of the iceberg on this. If I tried to teach all this history, we would all be bored. More than you are now, okay? Now, look at verse 28. While returning to his land with great riches. Who's returning to his land? Antiochus. Remember, Antiochus has been down to Egypt having these meals with Ptolemy. So he's going back to his land with great riches. Where am I? I'm sorry. Verse 28. Okay. His heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. Uh-oh. Okay. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. In other words, while they're in these meals together, they're paying each other off, all that stuff. He's going back with riches. But he's not happy one bit. Because what does he want? He wants Egypt. And he wants that king dead. But he can't. And he knows also that the Roman Republic is over on the other side going, don't you do that. All right? And so this man is very, very frustrated. Now, when you get a crazy man that's frustrated, you have some issues. Okay? Now, what does it say? Where's he going? He's going from here to here. But he's got to pass through here. And that's what it means. By that, I forgot what it says now. Yeah. He will be moved against the Holy Covenant. So he is frustrated because he can't take Egypt. And so he, at this point, and I don't have a date here for you. It's about 168 B.C. He takes out his frustration on these Jews. And at this point right here, he murders 80,000 Jews with his army. He deposed another high priest. He put his own high priest in there. And with the help of the new high priest, he goes into the Jewish temple and he desecrates it. And then after desecrating the temple, he felt better and then he went home. Okay? Now, that's not the only time he does that, but let's keep going. Verse 29. And at the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south. But it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved. Okay, let's just stop right there. All right, before we go on. Once more, what does he do? Goes from Syria down to Egypt. He says, I'm going to take this. But guess who interferes? Rome. Rome sends their navy and they send... the Roman Senate sends Gaius Papilius Leonis. And Gaius Papilius Leonis has a mandate from the Roman Senate saying, you will not attack Egypt. If you attack Egypt, we will attack you. And so Antiochus Epiphanes is trying to stall Ptolemy. And this was, when I took a history class, this was my favorite story because it's there. Antiochus Epiphanes is trying to stall, and so Gaius Papilius Leonis, I like saying that, says, fine. He takes his sword, he draws a circle in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes, and he says, if you walk out of that circle before giving me an answer, you have just declared war against Rome, and we will destroy you. Well, needless to say, Antiochus Epiphanes says, okay, I'll go back home. And so he goes back. Well, did he achieve his objective? Is he happy? And there's nothing like a crazy man that's not happy. So where does he go? Right back up. Now, keep reading. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage. Now, that's different from what he did before, right? Because all he did before was moved against the Holy Covenant. Here, he is grieved and he returns in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsook the Holy Covenant. This all happens about 168 B.C. still. He's ticked. So he goes through, guess what? He desecrates the temple again. He abolished all sacrifices. Well, what is the whole Jewish Mosaic law about? I mean, that's the way that they restore fellowship with God. That's the whole purpose of the temple and the altar. It's for the sacrifices. And what this king has just done is said, nope, you can't do it anymore. You think these Jews hated this guy? Couldn't stand him. Verse 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. There to get, he goes in again. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. There is a statue of Zeus placed upon the altar that the Jews are forced to worship. Not only does he do that, he sacrifices a pig on the altar. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. What we see here is that from Syria, he sent his general with 22,000 soldiers into Jerusalem, which is what's on your sheet there. And he attacked the Jews on the Sabbath day. Well, what are Jews doing on the Sabbath day? They're resting. And so many men were killed. Many of the Jewish women and children were taken as slaves at that point. They plundered and they burned the city. And then what he did is he set up this new sacrificial system where he required the Jews to sacrifice a pig on the altar every 25th day of the month. What did Jews think about pigs? All right. Now, what it says there is that some of the Jews will follow him in his deceitfulness. But the ones that are strong in their faith, there's a remnant there that will remain faithful. Those are the ones right there in that verse, in verse 32, those are who we come to know as the Maccabeans. That is your Maccabean revolt, or the beginnings of the Maccabean revolt, there in verse 32. What are they revolting? Antiochus epiphanies. Now, verse 33, "And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering." What's happening to many of those in the revolt? They're dying. That's what that says. Okay? "Now, when they fall, they shall be aided with little help." There's a small group of them. All right? "But many shall join them by intrigue." In other words, this movement starts off small. And there are a lot of them that die. But what happens is that the movement grows in momentum. And there are many that join them. "And some of those understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end." In other words, what does persecution do? What does persecution do to your faith? It strengthens it. That's what this is saying right here. In the end, these Maccabeans are much better in their faith, are much stronger in the Mosaic law than they were prior to that. Because they had a king that says, "You can't do that anymore. And if you do it, I'm going to kill you." All right? It says, "Until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed times." Now, what we see here is that this Maccabean revolt, there are a lot that stay with it. They are very faithful and they are refined until the end. Now, the end there is the death of Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. And he dies in 163 B.C. He dies insane and he dies of a disease. We're not told what disease. We're just told it has a disease. And so he dies. Now, verse 35 ends with that. All right? Now, I'll give you a spoiler. You want a spoiler? If you draw a big red line at the end of verse 35, but over verse 36, that red line would represent about 2,000 years of history. Because what you see in verses 1 through 35 is past. What you see in verse 36 on is still future. And verse 36 and on is about the Antichrist and it's about the tribulation. Okay? Now, I will also give you this heads up too. As we go into next week, did everybody see a pattern so far? What's the pattern? North, south, north, south, north. Syria, Egypt. Has everybody got that? Okay? Now, when we get into verse 36, we're continuing to see that pattern. North, south, north, south, north, south. Now, here's the rub. Here's where I differ. Up until this point, who's the king of the north? What's he the king over? Syria. Who's the king of the south? Egypt. And it's been that way for 30 verses, right? But yet we have all these scholars that when we get into 36, oh, the king of the north is somebody different. He's the king of Russia. Where did that come from? Are you understanding what I'm saying? See, there's this group think that comes together. Somebody came up with that, and then that's just been propagated throughout all this history. All right? Nobody said nothing. I'm doing that on purpose. Nobody said nothing about the king of the north being a different person in verse 36 than what he was in verse 35. Because all this time, the king of the north had been the Syrian kings. And all this time, the king of the south had been these Egyptian kings. So why would it change in verse 36? Why? It shouldn't. Okay? So, I'm just giving you a heads up. All right? I will teach this a little differently than you've heard it before. All right? You've probably heard before that verse 36 is the king of the north. That's the Russian czar or whatever. I don't buy that. Okay? Now, I'm not the only one on that little boat on an ocean. All right? But I'm not only one in the boat on that little ocean here. All right? So you can take it or leave it. All right? But I'm going to teach it this way. And when it's taught this way, it makes a whole lot more sense. Because I used to hold the fact, that the king of the north was Russian. But I couldn't understand where we made that jump. I couldn't see that. They get it from a translation of the battle of Gog and Magog over in Ezekiel 37 and 38. Okay? Which mine is different from that. All right?
I think I've heard that before.
Yeah, it may have been, but also, I mean, we have another bear that's a symbol of something else over in Daniel chapter 7,
okay.
Which is what? It's the Persians, yeah, but where's the Persians? Up there in that part right there where the king of Assyria is. Okay? All right. Now, here's the thing. I'm not trying to be divisive. Okay? But I also cannot teach, and this is a gray area anyway, I cannot honestly teach something that I don't believe that's not what the Scripture's teaching. So, it's either not teach it or teach it the way I want and say I'm not trying to be divisive. Because I'm not trying to be divisive. This is the way I see it. Okay? Alright, so, with that said, I'm tired of history. So, we'll start in verse 36 next week. Verse 36 is the time of the end. It's the latter days. It is smack dab in the middle of the tribulation period. And we're going to see then where the final battle between the king of the north and the king of the south that went on for centuries and centuries and will conclude in the future where it finally lands. Okay? All right. I'll pray. And then we can go. Thank you, Father, for your love and grace. Thank you for all you are. Pray, Father, for these folks. Please keep them safe. Give them the motivation to study and to open their Scriptures. And you know what? If they don't agree, they can go in there and look and figure out why they don't agree. That would make my day and yours too, I'm sure. God, I just pray that you would use them, grow their hearts and their minds, and just let them to be better disciples, better ministers of your new covenant. Thank you for all you are. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. All right. Thanks, guys.